The Tom Woods Show, episode 1867.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. We're joined today by our friend Sean Rittenour, who is a professor of economics at Grove City College. He is also the author of the textbook Foundations of Economics, which is really outstanding. And we're going to talk today about the subject of a book he's working on right now, which involves something called development theory. That is to say, how do countries develop? How do they go from, let's say, what we now today call less developed countries into developed countries? How do they go from, frankly, poor countries to being prosperous countries? That's exactly what he is looking at in what I would say is rather an important book, isn't that? That's a rather an important subject. So, Sean, welcome back to the show.
Well, Tom, as Minnie Pearl used to say, I'm just so proud to be here.
Well, listen, it's been so long since I had you on last. I feel funny saying welcome back. It's been quite some time, but I want to rectify that in the future. We can't have such a long gap between Sean Rittenour appearances, so we're gonna fix that. So today, I am giving the folks a bit of a reprieve. I did a couple of virus-related episodes right in a row. And I'm glad to say, actually, yesterday I had a guy on who has a book called Faucian Bargain about Anthony Fauci. And that book hit number one overall on Amazon. So
excellent.
I am taking full credit for that. It's the Tom Woods Show bump.
As well you should.
Yeah. So anyway, I said to people, look, the virus is taking a day off tomorrow. We're going to talk to Sean Rittenour. We're going to talk about development theory. And really what we are talking about, just for the general public, is how poor countries become rich countries and what are the factors that are involved. Now, there are different ways that economists have looked at this question over the years, and these different ways have their pluses and minuses. But since you're working on can I say that you're working on a book?
Yes, absolutely. You are correct on all words there. It is a book, and I am working on it.
Okay, that's the important thing. And it is related to this subject, and you're examining some of these attempts at understanding what the process is by which countries become wealthy. And yes, there are perhaps going to be particular Austrian insights that might help us understand that a bit better. But let's start off situating us in the problem. I think most people would think, let's forget about economists for a minute.
Yeah.
How do poor countries become rich? I wonder what the average person thinks about that. Do they think it's through foreign aid and the foreign aid jumpstarts them into prosperity, which, by the way, is not a million miles removed from how people after World War II thought it happened. That's not an exaggeration.
Absolutely.
Or is it just the adoption of good institutions? I mean, I don't know what the man on the street thinks, but...
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the man on the street, at least in most cities and towns and hamlets in the United States, probably don't even ask the question, how do poor countries become prosperous? I think that it's natural for all of us to take our current situation and see it as the norm and then sort of have historical blinders on. And so I think a lot of people, if there's a news program about a famine in some less developed country, and there's a food crisis, and especially, you know, the focus is on children starving, a lot of people look at that and say, oh, isn't that tragic? Why are these countries so poor? And they don't recognize that historically, we were all poor. Poverty was the norm. And the real question is not how are countries poor, but the question is, how did some countries who were poor become so prosperous? And so that's the best way to frame the question. And I think a lot of people in the U.S., in the prosperous West in general, just tend to take their own experience as norm. I mean, why else would you think, for instance, that healthcare is a right or that education is a right, other than we are prosperous enough that it's not really that big a deal for most people?
Yeah, exactly. And that, I think, the fact of our prosperity blinds us to a lot of important economic truths. It makes it seem like scarcity is not really a thing, because we think of scarcity just in the colloquial sense. There seems to be an abundance of everything.
Yes.
So the issue must just be a matter of we're not sharing enough or whatever. It can really blind you to economic analysis. I think what we should do is walk through the correct way of looking at this question first.
Yeah.
And then look at ways people have gone about it that have been incorrect. So
sure.
You, as an Austrian economist teaching at Grove City, working on a book on this, how do you describe to a reasonably intelligent lay audience what is actually involved in the process?
Yes. Well, first of all, you have to think, okay, given our desire to live rather than die, our preference for prosperity over poverty, our preference for civilization over barbarism, or at least I thought that that's what we, preferred. Looking around, some people you can't really tell all the time, but let's just suppose we prefer civilization to barbarism. We certainly prefer life to death, prosperity to poverty. It's clear that obviously the first thing we need to do is survive. And to survive, we need to consume. We need to consume food, clothing, and shelter. If we want to sustain a family, we want to be able to sustain a growing population, then we need to obviously produce more than enough just to sustain ourselves. We need to sustain our children, sustain our neighbor, and they need to do likewise. And so we need to increase productivity. We need to, we need to engage in production. We need to be able to engage in the act of combining land, labor, and capital goods to produce goods that we then consume, food, clothing, shelter, creature comforts, books, electronic devices, music, cultural artifacts, things like that. So, lawn furniture, what have you, fire pits, and we need to produce these things. And if we want to then become more prosperous, we need to find ways to increase our productivity because our labor is scarce and our human energy is scarce. But there's only so much labor a person can engage in a given day. And so in order to increase our prosperity, we need to find ways where using the same amount of labor, we can produce more goods that we can use to satisfy our ends. And going way back, actually, to you find evidence of this in the writings of Plato, and then certainly in Adam Smith and beyond, the division of labor was seen as an important contributor, I should say, to prosperity. It's the social phenomena that Mises referred to as the fundamental social phenomena. The division of labor is what explains the fact that people found it in their interest to participate in society and not be locked in a barbaric struggle for survival. So as each person specializes in producing those goods at which they are relatively more efficient, as everybody does this and they find their niche in society, society as a whole becomes more prosperous. And they have more goods with which they can consume, or they can have more goods that they can trade to other people for other goods that they'd like to consume as well. So the division of labor is actually a very important contributor to this process. But then to have a more developed division of labor, we need capital goods. And then so the accumulation formation of capital was very important. And the Austrian conception of the intertemporal capital structure is in many ways the other side of the division of labor coin. And so we need to save and invest in the production of capital goods we can use to further increase our productivity. So instead of trying to, farm with just our land and our hands and our labor, save and invest in a hoe or in some type of hand tool. And then as we become more productive, we're able to save and invest in maybe a plow, and then a plow and an oxen. And then if we get even more productive, we can save even more and invest in a tractor and a plow. In other words, as we get more capital intensive production, become more productive. And so the division of labor, capital formation, and then of course, as we produce more capital goods, the newer capital goods tend to be at a level of more advanced technology, right? So technology and technological advance is another key important contributor to this process. That when, for instance, an old machine wears out, often the machine that we, assuming we've saved enough to invest in and replace the old machine, often the new machine has more advanced technology. So it's even more productive than the previous machine. And so technological advance is important. All of those factors have been recognized by economists in general. What often is missed, and not by everybody, but by many economists, is the fact that all of this activity needs to be coordinated. All of this production activity within the Division of Labor, all of the investment decisions and the allocation of capital needs to be coordinated in a way so that we're not just sort of spending money on investment for investment's sake. We are investing in particular capital goods that will help us produce particular products that are actually desired and useful to people. And that takes a lot of coordination. And that's where the entrepreneur comes in. The entrepreneur is the one who directs factors of production towards their most productive use. It's the entrepreneur that, through his estimation of profit and loss, on the one hand, helps us not to squander already accumulated capital in projects that are wasteful. But then the prospects for profit also serve as an incentive to continually being innovative and trying to develop more products that are precisely the kind of products that best satisfy the consumers. Products that didn't exist before, not even in kind, now exist because entrepreneurs caught a vision for how profitable a particular product could be, because people, if they could have this product, they could really use it and they could really desire it so much to be very profitable. So the entrepreneur is the one that directs accumulated capital in ways and helps us refrain from squandering accumulated capital. But then also the entrepreneur is sort of the catalyst, the one who pushes us forward in terms of the variety of better quality and more numerous goods that people can use to satisfy their ends. And so entrepreneurship is very crucial. And that's one thing that tends to be missing from the sort of the standard view. And then if you understand the importance of capital and the importance of the division of labor and entrepreneurship, that's why you see the importance of institutions. And institutions, again, have become more recognized as being important for prosperity and development. But again, I would say it's institutions only in one aspect. But anyway, the institutions of private property and sound money are necessary for the entrepreneurs to effectively function and effectively allocate goods towards their most highly valued ends, to effectively have the incentive to produce, as well as the ability to wisely direct their factors of production to achieve the goals that they have an incentive to achieve. So institutions do matter. And then backing it all up, of course, is cultural factors. For instance, institutions aren't dropped out of the sky in toto, right? Institutions, by their very nature, develop over time as people develop certain habits and practices. And habits and practices are things that are formed out of a culture. There needs to be a culture, for instance, that supports a broader culture that supports private property. There needs to be a culture that supports sound money. That is the kind of culture we seem to be losing at present. And then there needs to be a culture of industriousness and a willingness to save, because in order to invest in the formation of capital, people have to be willing to save. They need to be willing to put off present consumption and save and redirect those savings towards the formation of capital. And that requires a certain long view of the future. People need to be future-oriented. They need to have what we would call relatively low time preferences. They need to be less present-oriented. And so they need to be willing to put off consumption, more willing to save. And as they do that, they'll accumulate more capital. The division of labor will be able to extend and will become even more productive and more prosperous over time. And so all of those things, I say, in my envision of things anyway, all of those are separate factors that we can analyze independently of one another. But the process of prosperity is one where all of these factors reinforce and reaffirm one another and work together for the entire process.
Now, having laid all that out, can you tell us then, what is it that we in the developed world, what, if anything, is it that we can do to assist other countries in this process? Because there are things that have been tried in the past,
yeah.
But is there really anything that can be done from the outside?
It's hard to do it from the outside if the less developed countries, or in particular their government, if the government of the less developed country is unwilling to allow the development of institutions that are necessary for these sources of prosperity to thrive. I think it's extremely difficult. Back in the, well, you mentioned after World War II, after the Keynesian Revolution, probably the earliest, so we say, modern model of development was one that thought that investment was it. And by investment, they meant the sort of Keynesian defined investment. It's spending on physical production. And it was, of course, just the big I, right? And so every dollar of investment was as effective as every other dollar of investment. It didn't matter what the investment was being spent on. If we were investing more, that increases our demand, that will increase output, and hence we will get more prosperity. And so there was this theory that developed, and it's still with us, quite frankly, that a lot of less developed countries are there because of the investment gap, that incomes are so low in these less developed countries that the domestic citizens do not, they just don't have high enough incomes to be able to save anything. I mean, realistically, they're living hand to mouth, and so they spend all their income on consumption. They don't have anything left over for saving, so they can't accumulate capital. So they're stuck in this vicious cycle of poverty because of the investment gap. This is essentially Jeffrey Sachs's argument in his book, In Poverty. So that's still with us. And so the Keynesians said, well, the solution obviously is foreign aid. We just direct foreign aid, give governments foreign aid to make up the gap. And if these less developed countries are so poor, we give them foreign aid. And so they'll have enough money to invest, and they'll be on the road to poverty. We sort of jumpstart the process, and they'll be on the road to poverty. Some
You mean on the road to prosperity?
Yeah, I'm on the road to prosperity. That's right. Sorry. Right. Sorry. Yes, on the road to prosperity. And so now, of course, the wiser of those people who advocated this did recognize that there might be some better and some worse ways of spending the money. So they would direct money to sort of infrastructure programs. But quite frankly, of course, a lot of this money just disappeared into the government coffers of the less developed countries. And it basically funded cronyism, like extreme cronyism. And in any event, even if it got down to the government bureaucrat who was really trying to promote development, you've got the problem of, shall we say, the entrepreneurial problem. Which projects should be funded? Which projects would actually be beneficial in providing goods that we know people desire, and they desire them enough to cover the cost of production? Well, that only can be determined through actual entrepreneurship, where entrepreneurs are comparing the price of the products that they're producing with some of the cost of production. And when you're trying to do things with foreign aid money, in some sense, there is no cost of production in terms of getting the finances, because the money's just given to them. And so they can do whatever they want to with it. And there was no profit and loss analysis. And so tremendous amounts of money were squandered. You know, large boondoggle infrastructure programs were undertaken. Billions of dollars, if not now trillions of dollars, were wasted. And so that type of program is just not very successful. And so I think if somebody in a more developed country wants to assist, it's crucial for the governments of the less developed country to allow for enough private property so that, for instance, foreigners that have savings can engage in foreign direct investment. They can invest directly into production in those countries. And by doing that, those less developed countries benefit from savings that were, you know, saved by foreigners. In many ways, it's not unlike what happened in the United States during the colonial era, where there was tremendous amount of savings invested from England into the colonies. Similarly, if there is Bangladesh or Malaysia and some Western capitalists have savings and they can direct those savings into those countries and engage in production, then all of a sudden you have people there in those countries that are now going to have access to capital goods that make them more productive, increasing their real wages, and sets them on the path to enjoying prosperity. So I think that's one thing that can happen. Also, another thing, Ben Powell makes this point that one thing we want to do is not make the situation worse. That I think some well-intentioned and then others not so well-intentioned people in the more developed countries, you will have, say, anti-sweatshop campaigns, and not realizing that the so-called sweatshops in these less developed countries, more often than not, we should say, are the best alternatives for the workers in these countries. And so it's not uncommon, for instance, and Ben Powell in his book, Out of Poverty, does a lot of good work on this. So he actually did some field research and went on the ground himself in some of these areas and saw that when these new factories opened up, the wage rate was extremely low by our standards, but there were lines of people hoping that they could get hired. Why? Because it was their best alternative. And I remember years ago when I was in graduate school, my old professor, Leland Yeager, said that if somebody is in a bad economic position because they have few good alternatives, you don't make their life better by reducing the number of alternatives that they have. And so,
yeah, or taking away the alternative they actually chose, the
exactly.
option they chose.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is
absolutely.
David R. Henderson's line. Yeah. So, on Ben Powell's research, what I like about it is he went to Guatemala and he also asked them,
yeah,
would you like to have these various amenities
yes.
in exchange for a slightly lower paycheck? And 90 to 95 plus % of them said, no, I'd rather have the full money. And that's exactly how we all act. You know, as you get wealthier over the course of your life, you realize that you'd be willing to maybe work fewer hours, even though you know it means less money. You'd be
yep.
willing to do a whole lot of things,
yep.
maybe get a maid come over to your house, even though you know it's going to cost you money, because you have enough prosperity to be able to make that work.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And at some point, and it was the case for these people that have been interviewed, what really mattered to them more than, shall we say, more delightful working conditions was the money, right? And the only way for people to sort that out is allow for there to be a free market where you can have a firm. The firms, the employers can compete on working conditions and on wages. And, you know, the competition will sort out what it is that people actually want.
Hey, folks, just a quick break in our conversation with John to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. I know that like me, a lot of you are interested in cryptocurrency. And I know you wish you could get in a time machine and go back and buy up a lot of Bitcoin when it was dirt cheap. But the next best thing is to use Bitcoin to diversify your portfolio and add it to your retirement account. Well, how can you do that? BitTrust IRA is going to make that super easy for you. They help you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. They store your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. And BitTrust IRA has a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. And they also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. So go to BitTrustIRA.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's BitTrustIRA.com/woods. BitTrustIRA.com/woods. Now, I've written a little bit in a book or two about the foreign aid question, and there was a kind of consensus that developed after a while, maybe around the 1980s, that the traditional development aid programs had kind of misfired and had had a lot of, I hate to use this expression, unintended consequences, because the consequences of so many of these government programs are so consistently predictable and
yeah.
damaging that if they're really unexpected or unintended, then the people implementing them are just dumb at this point.
Yeah,
you know,
it's the Charlie Brown effect, right? That
yeah.
Well, this time Lucy won't pull the football.
Exactly, exactly. But so then it became, well, look, we know that if you give aid directly to a bad government, then they're never going to reform because you've subsidized them continuing the way they are. And the way they are involves policies that undermine entrepreneurship, capital formation, saving, the rule of law, all these other things that you need for prosperity. So we get that. So now what we want to do is just try and aim. And so this became known as the new development economics. Now we're going to aim the money at really nice people. And there was a whole slate of people. In fact, there was a guy I'll never forget. His name is David Dollar. Like, that's his actual name.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It was
oh,
David
yeah.
Dollar
yeah.
who did work on this. But the long and the short of it is they started to say, well, if we could just direct it to the right. But even that has its problems. So, but meanwhile, I want to make sure we hit on something that you wrote about in a recent article that you sent me, that sometimes you get people looking at this question who focus too much on just one thing. And not just about development, but any country and what leads to prosperity. There are a lot of people who think, like even Rothbard had to deal with this, that it's just technology, knowledge. You know, what we need is knowledge and technology, and that's the recipe. But of course, if you don't have the capital to make the technology a reality, all the ideas in the world aren't going to do it. So what are the major blind spots then that people have had on this?
Yeah, I do think that I would say sort of the consensus now. Well, let me back up the truck. So it was the case, I think, that coming out of the 50s, driven by sort of a Keynesian understanding of macroeconomics, there was the idea that, well, investment is the key. In fact, there even was developed a phrase called investment fundamentalism, that investment was the sole thing. So all we need to do, if we want to help these countries, is boost their investment, boost their big I, and then prosperity would follow. Well, in the late 50s, Robert Solow develops his growth model, and he models the entire macroeconomy as one giant short-run production function, neoclassical production function. And it's in the short run, which means that we're going to assume that investment is variable, but there are fixed inputs such as human labor. In other words, if population stays relatively the same and we continue and continue and continue to support capital into a situation, at some point we're going to get diminishing returns. And what that would implies then that we can get to a point where we get to this sort of the steady state where we can no longer increase the rate of economic growth, economic expansion by simply investing more. So if we hit that point and we can no longer increase economic prosperity or rates of growth in economic prosperity by increasing investment, by increasing savings and increasing investment, what can we do? Well, technology. Technology will increase the total factor productivity, will increase the productivity of labor, yes, but then also capital. And so technology then became sort of the big thing. And I would say probably from the, I don't know, 60s or 70s onward, perhaps, there's a period of time where these things were for debate, but we're definitely, I would say, in a time of what we could call technology fundamentalism, that technology is the key thing. And oh, I don't know how, if just a few years ago, I saw, it was actually just a little blog post, I think, by Robert Higgs, and the title was, "There is no monocausal economic growth or economic prosperity." And his point was that economic development is a historical process. It's not something that we get by pulling one lever to the exclusion of everything else and holding all other things equal, and then prosperity just follows. As I sort of alluded to earlier on, we can't actually sever the components responsible for economic expansion from one another and find the single key that explains economic progress. And if I may plug my own work a little bit, that's one of the points of the book that I am working on, is that to understand the process of economic prosperity, we need a synthesis. We need to recognize that, for instance, as I said, a highly developed division of labor would be impossible without the accumulation and use of capital goods in the different specialized tasks that people participate in. Likewise, the entrepreneur must invest in real capital in the production process. Entrepreneurs are not just decision makers. They're people that engage in actual production. Well, they need actual factors of production to do this. Technological improvement, technology, which is important, but it's not autonomous. It doesn't happen by itself. Technological improvement, for it to be actually relevant for the production process, technological improvement requires saving and the application of saved resources to research, development, and innovation. And once we discover a new way to do things, for it to be used in production, the technology has to be embodied in actual capital goods. And so that also requires saving and investment decisions in time and space. At the same time, Mises pointed out that capital does not beget profit, meaning capital per se never guarantees economic progress because capital goods could always be squandered, right? We can accumulate all these capital goods and use them in ways that were foolish. I mean, I argue that that was a main failure of the foreign aid programs, the boondoggles that were engaged in from the 50s onward, when we thought that all the only thing matters is saving investment. So we just direct investment foreign aid funds to less developed countries. And then however they spend it, we're going to get prosperity. Well, no, if you take those savings and invest them even in capital goods that don't get used to produce goods that people want, well, it's just waste. It's not capital accumulation, it's waste. And so the capital that is accumulated needs to be invested wisely. And that's, again, where entrepreneurship comes in. So all the coordination and production within the division of labor, all of the coordination of the accumulation and application of capital goods, the selection and utilization of specific technology requires entrepreneurial judgment. And so I would argue that economic progress is what we call the happy consequence of a highly developed division of labor taking advantage of an increasing stock of better, higher quality capital goods wisely invested by entrepreneurs. So you need all of those things together, working together to achieve economic expansion and development.
So let's suppose when your book comes out, let's suppose the president of some very poor country reads it. What course of action would you want him to take on the basis of what you've written?
One thing I would encourage him to do what he could to participate more fully in the global division of labor. So eliminate tariffs and quotas. The number one thing I think that less developed nations could do is to get themselves plugged into the global division of labor, because that way they will be able to have access to a host of other goods that right now they don't have access to. And that, of course, requires private property rights and the freedom to trade and exchange with whomever and under whatever conditions they desire.
That's not exactly the New Deal here. It's very much the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. This book is coming out in a series, New Thinking on Political Economy. And in some sense, it's like everything old is new again. In many ways, I don't consider what I'm doing necessarily groundbreaking, because you can find, especially, like you mentioned, especially in the Austrian literature, I think what's new is recognizing that the Austrian tradition is rich in all of this, rich in both the analysis and the synthesis. And you know, how's that for a dialectic? So anyway, the analysis and the synthesis of the Austrian literature is rich in, and it's just sort of trying to put these insights to the forefront and in some sense saying, look, if we would have pursued this path 50 years ago, we'd be a whole lot better off, both in the more developed countries and in the less developed countries.
One last thing before we go. We were at the Austrian Economics Research Conference, the Mises Institute, a couple of weeks ago. And
yes,
that's where I saw you for the first time in a while.
Yeah.
And listening in to some of the paper presentations, it finally hit me, after all these years, just how often the entrepreneur is mentioned in an Austrian setting. Entrepreneurship just kept getting mentioned over and over and over again. So I was trying to explain to Jenna what the deal with that was. Like, why would that be that there's such an Austrian emphasis on it? And I guess, and this isn't directly related to what you've been talking about, but I just can't, but you kept, again, you kept talking about the entrepreneur also. And it seems to me that it's in large part because the Austrians are focusing on a real-life economy as it develops in real time. It's not looking at static states. It's not looking at a snapshot of the economy. It's not looking at long-run equilibrium where everything is at its most value-productive use and everything is allocated. No, we're looking at the difficult process of getting there, even though we never do ultimately reach such a state. The process of getting there is the messy process of actually figuring out how do I make adjustments of resources in such a way as to best serve consumers, but in the least cost, least wasteful way that doesn't interfere with other people's projects, trying to aim at the satisfaction of other consumer preferences. This is the actual hard and interesting part of the economy. That is what the entrepreneur is doing. But it seems like in modern economics, the entrepreneur is kind of written out of the story because he's just a functionary at that point, because they've already skipped ahead to the part where all his work is done. Unless I'm missing something.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely correct. It's, in some sense, seems cliche-ish for those who are in the Austrian tradition and perhaps, quite frankly, those who are without. It comes back to the praxeological understanding of economics, meaning that all economic phenomena is the result of human action. And we don't help anybody if we are going to try to develop a theory based on such an artificial view of action that the theory is completely irrelevant for the actual problems and situations that producers find themselves in. And so, yeah, it's recognizing the fact that when people engage, and this is not just a producer, but people in general, when they engage in action, it's always forward-looking. They're doing something now to accomplish a particular end that will not be realized into the future. Even if it's drinking a glass of water. If I'm thirsty, I think, oh, I've got a glass of water here. I'm going to drink it. And you drink it. And the satisfaction, the saging of the thirst, happens a nanosecond into the future. Right? So all action is forward-looking. And the future is uncertain. We don't know exactly how the future is going to pan out. We may be more certain about certain things and less certain about other things. I've come to resign myself, right, that I'm not going, I know I'm not going to win the Nobel Prize in economics. I never had that really fantasy. I had a fantasy, but I never knew it was never going to happen. But you know what I'm saying? The future is uncertain. So the point is that every act of production is a production in the present, and the revenue is not going to occur until after it's sold. And so there is a present future dimension to every act of production. And because the future is uncertain, it requires judgment. And so that is what the entrepreneur does. That's the entrepreneurial function. And you're right. The mainstream, the conventional economic theory on this sort of writes the entrepreneur out of the picture, because in order to make the economics mathematically tractable, you import the assumption of information, whereby the producer knows what the demand is. They know what their demand is. They know what their competitors are going to do. They know what the prices of their factors are. They know the best technologies that exist. They know everything that's relevant to the production process. Well, in that type of world, there is no room for the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur really doesn't exist. All you have are managers. And you have managers that can solve a relatively trivial calculus problem, or, you know, press the button on a computer and voila, out comes the optimal quantity and the optimal price and away we go. And it completely assumes away the real economic problem that needs to take place. I mean, the idea that we could somehow by a press of the button solve the economic calculation problem, the problem of allocating resources in real time by simply pressing a button, of course, is completely and utterly fanciful. These allocation decisions are real decisions made by real people. How does that happen? It happens when people who have their own property on the line, have their own skin in the game, they make the investment decisions. So they have incentives that line up with the desires of the consumers, because the prices that they use to calculate profit and loss in a free market, those prices are reflections of people's subjective preferences. So when an entrepreneur does act in such a way to produce a good that reaps a profit, he reaps a profit for precisely doing what the people in society want him to do. There is no, you know, Marxist dichotomy between production for use and production for profit. And in a free market, people produce for profit because they're producing for use. Right? The consumers will pay prices that are profitable because the good is so useful to them in satisfying their end. And so the entrepreneur is actually key. And it is funny. So you mentioned, I remember years ago when I first read Mises's Human Action. And he, Mises taught, said that the, you know, that the entrepreneur was the driver of the economy, essentially. And I thought, well, you know, he's clearly enthusiastic about the entrepreneur. He seems a bit, he overstates the case a little bit. He's a little bit hyperbolic there. And the more I think about it, the more I understand, for instance, that Peter Klein stresses the importance of entrepreneurial judgment and how many decisions in the production process have to be made in this environment of uncertainty, you realize that Mises was right, that the entrepreneur is so important. And so if we're going to try to do any production theory or any theory of economic prosperity, economic expansion, development, and if we try to do it without the entrepreneur, we're just pretending.
Sean, I'm going to let you get going, but I want to tell people before I do that, that on the show notes page, which for this episode is tomwoods.com/1867, I'm going to link to the Mises Reader that you edited. And I just want to tell you, I think that genuinely is the best introduction to Mises, because you've taken bits and pieces of his work that are accessible, that are relevant, that are readable, and put them together in just a fantastic introduction. Because I find with Mises, you either have, some people find Human Action to be quite difficult, and then you have, or very, very simple, like, was it like Economic Policy Thoughts for Today and Tomorrow? Or I forget what the, yeah. I mean, that's like super duper, like way too simple. The happy medium, I actually think, is your volume. So if people have been wanting to read Ludwig von Mises, that is a terrific place to start. So I think maybe you wanted to say something about my praise of you there, but honestly, that is such great work.
Oh, thank you so much. That was very kind of you.
So definitely check that out, folks. You can read it for free. You can get that book for free. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1867. Well, thank you, Sean. We should talk more. Thanks so much for doing this.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure as always.
Okay, everybody, before I let you go, this is a very valuable service for people who listen to podcasts. Maybe you're listening to a podcast and you hear a guest who just blows you away and you want to hear more from that particular guest, but that guest doesn't have his or her own podcast. So what do you do? Well, there's a site, ivy.fm, just ivy.fm, that helps you do that kind of thing. So if you hear a great guest on my show, you want to follow all relevant episodes across all podcasts for that person, you can do that with ivy.fm. But in addition to people, you can follow specific topics like homeschooling, the 10th Amendment Center, the Mises Institute, and much more. And of course, you can follow podcasts. But this is a way to go cross-podcast and to be able to follow topics that are of interest to you. So it's a really neat idea, and it was created by a listener of The Tom Woods Show. So go check it out at ivy.fm. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1867. And of course, you know, person is getting promotion for this because he got the hosting through my link. So you go to Bluehost, get your hosting through the Tom Woods link. Where do you get the Tom Woods link? At tomwoods.com/publicity. And in return, I'll give you publicity and some other great bonuses that are really going to help you get some traffic and get some knowledge about how to do all this stuff right out of the gate. So check out tomwoods.com/publicity for how you can get all these goodies before you start that website you're thinking of starting. Tomorrow, if all goes well, Dave Smith is back on the program. We've got some serious issues to talk about. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.